This episode of The Dig, and every episode of The Dig, is brought to you in partnership with Jacobin. Jacobin celebrates International Workers' Day with solidarity subscriptions. The goal of Jacobin is to reach millions with the argument that creating a better world requires challenging those who profit from the misery and exploitation of others. And one way we reach more people is through this special May Day offer. On May 1st, you can use code MAYDAYDIG, all one word, MAYDAYDIG, one word, at checkout to get a year-long digital subscription to Jacobin for just $1 or $10 for a full year of their beautiful print magazine. You can also access this discount by following the link in this episode's description. This offer also applies to all gift subscriptions. So if you want to read Jacobin with a friend, May Day is a great time to introduce someone to this great publication. Welcome to The Dig, a podcast from Jacobin Magazine. My name is Daniel Denver, and I'm broadcasting from Providence, Rhode Island. This is the 8th episode of Thawara, The Dig's rolling series on 20th century Arab politics with historian Abdel Razak Tikriti. Thawara is Arabic for revolution. It's a word that contains historical multitudes, diverse political radicalisms and revolts that have swept across Arab lands over the past century. Our last installment covered U.S.-backed attacks, preventative counter-revolution, as Nasser rallied the Arab world, first against the imperialist-aligned Baghdad Pact, and then amid the Suez Crisis tripartite aggression. It was a counterinsurgent strategy that included attempted coups in Syria in 1956 and 1957. U.S. President Eisenhower rebranded the Monroe Doctrine for the Middle East as the Eisenhower Doctrine and landed U.S. Marines in Lebanon. We ended that episode by discussing the unification of Syria and Egypt as the Nasser-led United Arab Republic. Syria was looking for protection against Iraqi, Israeli, and Western aggression. Syrian Ba'athists, in particular, sought to fulfill their foundational dream of Arab unity. They also, however, wanted to outflank their rival communists. Political parties, the communists and the Ba'ath alike, were banned upon the new superstate's creation. The Ba'ath thought that they would come out on top. As we'll see in future episodes, it didn't turn out quite like they had imagined. This episode is a brief in dig terms. It's a compact introduction to the movement of Arab nationalists, founded as the Arab Nationalist Youth in 1951. It's a really influential organization throughout the 1950s, though not as powerful as the Ba'ath or the communists. But it builds a powerful presence in Beirut and in Jordan, and it becomes a really, truly powerful force in Kuwait, a country whose politics we discuss at some length today. The movement of Arab nationalists was also, from its foundation, notably, in significant part led by Palestinians. The organization ultimately becomes critical to the history of Arab anti-colonial radicalism in general and to Palestinian National Liberation Movement politics in particular because it leads to the creation of multiple radical Marxist groups, including the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the major left-wing faction of the struggle, South Yemen's National Liberation Front, which in 1967, after the British departure, established the Socialist People's Democratic Republic of Yemen, and the Dhofar Liberation Front, which carried out an armed guerrilla struggle against the Sultan of Muscat and Oman throughout the late 1960s and early 1970s. We'll get to all three of these left-wing revolutionary Marxist organizations in our final episodes. But interestingly, throughout the 1950s, the movement of Arab nationalists, until 1958, the Arab Nationalist Youth, during this time, the organization is not Marxist. In fact, they adopted a form of anti-Marxist Arab nationalism that was hostile to communism. Nevertheless, it was a powerful force, and it later became a supremely influential incubator for emancipatory currents that would define the next phase of mass revolutionary politics in the Arab world. Its early history gives us a ground view look at the growing organizational and theoretical currents shaping revolutionary nationalists and the conditions of possibility for mass Arab politics. It also sets us up really well for our next episode, which is on the context for the rise of the Palestinian National Liberation Movement in the 1950s. Before we get started, I need to ask you two things. First, support The Dig on Patreon. You know the deal. This is a political education podcast, and we don't paywall anything because we want the maximum number of people on earth to listen. And the reason that's possible is because listeners like you support us. Plus, we have thank you gifts. Please contribute now. That's patreon.com/The Dig. Do it. There's a link in the show notes. Second, Thawara is The Dig's most ambitious political education project ever. The most ambitious thing we've ever done. And we want more people to find it. The Arab and Palestinian history that Abed is laying out here is the political education that this increasingly third worldist and internationalist left needs right now. Please spread the word on social media and by word of mouth. Take a minute to tap out a tweet or to tell a friend. Thanks. And here's Abdelrazak Tikriti, who teaches history at Rice University. A scholar of Arab and Palestinian revolutionary movements, he's the author of Monsoon Revolution, Republicans, Sultans, and Empires in Oman, and the co-author of The Palestinian Revolution Digital Humanities Website, an incredible resource that will be back online soon. In the early 1950s, a Palestinian medical student at the American University of Beirut, George Habash, who was made a refugee by the Nakba, becomes an absolutely pivotal figure in the Palestinian national liberation struggle. He, along with others in the early 1950s, led the founding of an organization called the Movement of Arab Nationalists. It was Habash and others who were studying with the important political theorist of Arab nationalism, Constantine Zurek, who we discussed probably in the second episode of the series. And the movement becomes extraordinarily consequential in significant part because it would later lead to the creation of a really striking number of other really consequential groups, including the Marxist Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, South Yemen's National Liberation Front, and the Dhofar Liberation Front in Oman, all groups that we'll discuss more when we get into the 1960s in future episodes. What was the Movement of Arab Nationalists at its founding and then throughout the 1950s, both ideologically and organizationally? What was their vision of Arab nationalism and where did Palestinian liberation fit within that?
Right. So when we look at the Movement of Arab Nationalists and its foundation, we have to think of the mentorship that its initial founders received. These were students at the American University of Beirut. They included two Palestinian medical students, George Habash and Wadia Haddad. They included a Kuwaiti medical student, Ahmed Al-Khatib. They also included other youth, especially Hani Al-Hindi from Syria, and various other figures that were associated with these students. Now, this group of young people from different Arab countries were studying under Constantine Zurek, not necessarily directly, because these were not studying in the humanities with Zurek. They were, however, part of a student scene in which Zurek played a huge role. They were involved in a student society called Al-Urwa Al-Wuthqa. And that student society was a very famous one in Beirut. It grew in the American University there. And it included a lot of intellectuals that contributed to many different currents of Arab life. And the elections for that group often were heated because this was essentially a place in which the intellectual elite of the Arab world would congregate. At a time when there were very few universities in the region, you had the advantage in places like Beirut, but also in Cairo and elsewhere, of attracting people from all over the region. And anyone that was studying in university at the time, and you know, we're talking here in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, knew that they were accessing a rare privilege, and that they were going to have a career ahead of them, and that they will play a role that is influential in their societies, because there was so little education available at the highest levels. The colonial authorities, as we've heard in previous episodes, were not investing in education, and therefore the opportunities were limited.
Constantine Zurich was a scholar and a teacher, of course. He was this very influential father of Arab nationalism, the person who first used the term Nakba, or catastrophe, to refer to the Zionist destruction of Palestine in 1948. But did Zurich and this older generation of Mandate era Arab nationalists, did they just influence this new generation of young radicals ideologically, or was there also an organizational or more concretely political lesson or legacy that was at work?
The group of students that was involved in the student society, Al-Urwa Al-Wuthqa, were receiving this mentorship from Constantine Zurich, who was also very involved in it as a faculty mentor. They were knowingly or unknowingly also being influenced by the current that Zurich himself had enrolled in. There was an early group that was founded in 1929 that was known as the Secret Arab Society. It had multiple names. Some people called it the Secret Arab Society. Another name for it was the Clandestine Arab Movement. Another name was the Red Book Group, because there was a Red Book before Mao's Red Book that basically promoted classical Arab nationalist principles. This was a group that was focused on the idea of the unity of all Arab countries. And it included major figures like the Darwish al-Maqdadi from Palestine, like Adel Husayran from Lebanon, and a variety of other figures from Iraq and Kuwait and Syria and Lebanon and Jordan. So essentially, these were the former Ottoman territories, Arab Ottoman territories in the Mashriq, in the Arab East. And the group basically was formed to facilitate common action against colonialism in these countries, all of which were languishing under colonialism at the time. Many of them had participated in the revolts, the major big revolts that took place in the region, particularly the Iraqi and Syrian revolt. And many of them considered that they needed to learn lessons from that. Many of them were concerned at the lack of effective coordination on a pan-Arab level. One case in point that they used to always mention was, well, the Syrian revolt happened at around the same time as the Reef Rebellion in Morocco. Both were major anti-colonial episodes against the same enemy, France. So why wasn't there a coordination taking place between the leaderships of these two revolts? So they were asking questions of that sort, and they wanted to create a coordinating body, but one that would work in clandestine ways and push an agenda of reform, social transformation, and also anti-colonial action rooted in classical nationalist principles. So these were people that viewed the nation as the main body that any movement should focus on. And they were not at this stage emphasizing class. They were emphasizing national unity, but they were emphasizing national unity in an anti-colonial context. And that was the progressive dimension to their equation. Their actual program, when it came to the social agenda, was not of the sort that would be counted as radical by our standards. However, they were talking about education. They were talking about the provision of education, the provision of social reforms, that would have benefited the poor as well as other sections of society. But essentially, when we look at these groupings, and this group in particular, its base was the student movement, and to a lesser extent, an emerging officer class that was being trained within the colonial structure of Britain and France, you know. But of course, Britain and France were overseeing mandates, as we mentioned in earlier episodes. So they were developing local armies. And these local armies were relying on young people entering them and receiving officer training within them. And through that, you know, they were getting some education. So they were getting exposed to these ideas, and they were believing in action around them. Kostis Rig, who was like a major educator and ended up being a professor at AUB. We spoke about him before. He wrote the famous book, The Meaning of Catastrophe, in response to the Palestinian Nakba of 1948. He had been part of that group. And they contributed to many different episodes, including in 1936, when there was the great revolt in Palestine. They also established cultural clubs in various major Arab capitals, in which they were advocating, you know, Arab nationalist principles and trying to recruit people towards them with a special focus against colonialism. In different countries, they operated under different agendas and towards different ends, depending on local needs. For example, in Kuwait, the focus was on building education and building civic education that would not be under the control of the local emir or the British colonialists. And that's why they were able to establish the first independent civic schools in Kuwait. It was members of this group that played a big role in that experiment. And they insisted on bringing teachers from Palestine who were known for their Arab nationalist views. And they got even the Mufti of Palestine to select those teachers. Now, our listeners might think that this is a tangential or minor point. But actually, these teachers, which were four teachers from Palestine, were able to essentially kickstart a major pan-Arabist educational program in Kuwait that instilled anti-colonial consciousness in the first generation of educated Kuwaiti students of the 1930s. There had been earlier experiments in education in Kuwait, particularly in the early 1920s, but the schooling experiment in which the members of the Arab clandestine movement were involved in was more radical, and it was more geared towards pan-Arabist visions. That's why Kuwait became such an important place for the development of pan-Arabist views. Many people wonder, why is it that Kuwait played such a big role? And this will help us understand that. A second element in Kuwait was that the members of this group pushed for a reform movement that demanded greater constitutionalism, greater restrictions on the power of the local emir or prince, and more participation from the population. Some of them were even advocating unity with Iraq, and that became like a major theme. During that period, this was before the discovery of oil, of course, it made sense because many Kuwaitis, especially from the merchant class, which furnished many members of this secret society, had interests in Iraq. So this is on the Kuwaiti level. In Lebanon, you had a different environment. In Lebanon, the main purpose of this group was to push for a pan-Arabist agenda at a time when you had two other competing currents in Lebanon. One was insisting on the notion of a separate Christian identity that would separate primarily Mount Lebanon, but also the areas around it, from the surrounding Arab world. So this, of course, was a project that was promoted by the French. And another competing vision from Lebanon, so this was a de-Arabized version for Lebanon, completely de-Arabized, but also de-Syrianized version for Lebanon. You had another version of politics in Lebanon that we spoke about before. There was a current under Anton Saadé, but of course it had relied on previous visions that were very widespread in Lebanon in the 19th century that emphasized Lebanon's connection to Syria. And, you know, since the days of the famous Lebanese intellectual Boutros al-Bustani in 1860, he wrote about the importance of Syrian identity. And he used to say that the Ottoman Empire is our state, but Syria is our homeland. So this current was emphasizing pan-Syrianism, and later on under Anton Saadé, of course, it takes an organized form. In the meantime, members of pan-Arabist groups like the clandestine movement were talking about Arab unity as a whole and Lebanon as being an integral part of the broader Arab region. So I'm giving you these two examples, but there are many others, to show you the atmosphere that was prevailing at the time. These were the ideas that had existed even before the movement of Arab nationalists was born in 1949, and later on it helped it grow. It was influenced by these ideas, but it was also influenced by the networks that were in existence and that had been established by this previous generation, And today, not many historians know about that. And even some members of the movement of Arab nationalists, they think that it's just, you know, there was this mentor, Kostis Rek, in AUB, and he taught some students. Well, Kostis Rek was actually a major political actor. He'd been involved in a clandestine movement, and his students benefited from an existing set of structures that they had no clue about. They only discovered it later on as they progressed in life. They found all these people helping them without them even knowing.
You just laid out this deep and little known critical historical context that allowed the movement of Arab nationalists to form and then expand across the region. What was the movement of Arab nationalists when it was formed and throughout the 1950s, both ideologically and organizationally? How did it, starting in Beirut, spread across the region in the way that it did? And then also, what was ideologically their vision of Arab nationalism, and where did Palestinian liberation fit within that?
So these young people that were studying in Beirut in the late 1940s were influenced by the Nakba. That was the biggest influence on them. And two of the core members of this group, Zohr Zahabash and Wadi Haddad, came from an area that had witnessed major massacres during the Nakba, which was, of course, Lid. These were people who belonged to middle-class Christian families in this town. They witnessed the destitution of their families and their neighbors. They had been expelled from their hometown. They were forced to march under horrific circumstances. And, you know, these were medical students. And in the case of Habash, he even went and volunteered there and saw the Nakba unfolding before his own eyes as a young, you know, emerging medical doctor. He still hadn't yet finished his training, and he was having to treat all these cases and witness all these horrors and essentially see his family lose everything. And he wrote about this, you know, he wrote about the impact of the horrors that affected him personally. His own family sustained losses. And so this was very personal. And, you know, of course, those two students, and by the way, here we should remember, this is like typical student life. They were coming back to study after having spent the time volunteering in Palestine. And their parents had no money to send them. So they even had to like live without any pocket money, without rent money. And what they did was that they would share the pocket money of the Kuwaiti friend, Ahmed al-Khatib, who also talked about the horrors of this period in his memoirs later on. You know, the three of them were very close, and they would just share, like, you know, whatever money he had. He was a poor student on a scholarship. You know, he later became the first, by the way, Kuwaiti medical doctor trained in modern medicine. So the three would share this money. They were living in poverty. They were affected by what's going on. And they were volunteering also in the newly set up Palestinian refugee camps. They were going to Ain al-Hilwa refugee camp. And there they were seeing the spread of diseases. It's kind of like what's happening in Gaza today. All these people that were hungry and downtrodden and displaced and forced out of their villages and towns in the most horrific ways, each one of them carrying a story of enormous suffering and also living in crowded conditions. And you had all these diseases, including cholera spreading. And, you know, Ahmed al-Khatib talks about how they were trying to treat those cases, witnessing them firsthand. They were also meeting some of the fighters that had fought in Palestine. Again, as medical students, they saw the admission of one of the heroes of the 1948 war in Palestine, Ibrahim Abu Dayyeh, into the AUB hospital, into the American University of Beirut hospital. And they were sitting with him. He taught them about what was going on, about the history of resistance in Palestine. They were impacted by that atmosphere, and it got chiseled into their minds. Now, they were also impacted by the philosophy that Qassantin Zurekh had articulated in The Meaning of Catastrophe, or Ma'na al-Nakba, his main book on the Nakba, that was written actually while the Nakba was happening. And there, the idea was that a select group of young people that were educated, but that had a sense of civic responsibility, and that were virtuous, and that had the highest morality and principles. There was this focus on ethics and morality and principle and sacrifice. in their minds. It was that kind of vision. That group was going to lead the way in accordance with this philosophy, and its mission was to transform and revolutionize Arab countries that were responsible for the loss of Palestine. And they were responsible because they had not grappled with modernity effectively, they had not modernized quickly enough, they had not united to be able to confront the settler colonial project that is backed by the entire Western world. So these young men thought that they had a responsibility to do that. So this view was influenced, of course, by 19th century European models, Italian Carbonari, all these young Europe societies, all these 1830s groups. They were also influenced by that kind of thinking, because the idea of the Risorgimento or the German unification sounded relevant for people like Konstantin Zurich and his students, because they thought, like, okay, this region has so much in common. It shares a similar language. It has the same language. It has the same kind of culture. It has similar religions, the same religion, basically. And essentially, there's so much in common. So why is it divided? It's divided to benefit external powers, and that division has to be overthrown. That was their philosophy. So it's not surprising that the Italian Carbonari and these kind of movements that were operating in the run-up to the Risorgimento in Italy had played a big influence on them. Many of these people were looking towards figures like Mazzini and others, and they were thinking about that. But also they were influenced by the organizational model, the idea of secrecy, the idea of codes and signs, the idea of certain rituals that would bond people together. They would do these kind of secret ceremonies. That's why, of course, they were seen as having a romantic streak at that stage, and they were seen to be promoting a romantic version of nationalism at the time. And that was certainly an accusation that they themselves later on embraced as they engaged in autocritique in later years.
I want to ask some follow-up questions of both the movement's ideology and its organization. First, ideologically, it's clear here what you're describing. The movement of Arab nationalists at this point is not communist or Marxist. Later that changes. But they adhered to something they called the theory of the separation of stages. And it held, if I understand it correctly, that national revolution, that the unity of Arab capitals into a common national front, that had to precede social revolution. And that it was only once there was this political integration into a common Arab nation, and then after that, only once Zionism had been defeated, that it would be possible to struggle either for socialism or for democracy, or to grapple with the social question, or whatever that might look like. What was the significance of this position? Because, I mean, it might seem kind of abstract or academic at first, but this question, these questions, the relationship between the national and social revolution was at the heart of so many debates across the 20th century, from the Soviet Union, India, China, across Latin America, Asia, Africa. Many, many, many activists involved in a diversity of national liberation and social struggles were trying to figure out the relationship between national liberation and the sort of cross-class alliances that national liberation might require. And then on the other hand, these questions around socialism and more egalitarian policies that would put a national liberation movement at odds not only with the colonizer, but with the domestic bourgeoisie as well. What was it about this conjuncture of the post 48 years that made this strictly nationalist or stagist project so appealing to the movement? And how did the movement's analysis compare to other groups that we've been discussing in the 1950s? The communists were, of course, communists, and we've talked about changes in the Soviet Union's approach to national liberation struggles and the national bourgeoisie, particularly after Stalin's death. And then we have Nasserists and Baathists who become increasingly socialist in various ways over the decade.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's start by emphasizing that at this stage, it's not yet the movement of Arab nationalists. Let's start from that starting point. It is at this stage, from 1949 onwards, it's still called the Arab Nationalist Youth. So, Shabab al-Qawmi al-Arabi. But it is essentially, you know, later on it changes its name, and in 1958 it becomes the Movement of Arab Nationalists, but it's essentially the same movement. So, but to answer your question on the ideological side, the main arena in which the Movement of Arab Nationalists was functioning, and, you know, its earlier iteration, the Arab Nationalist Youth was functioning in, was an arena in which you had a communist current that was available, and in which you had another competing, an older Arab Nationalist formation, which was the Ba'ath Party, that was also there. And the Movement of Arab Nationalists needed to distinguish itself from those formations. But also, you might ask, why didn't they just join the Ba'ath, for example? I mean, we can understand why didn't they join the communists. They were, this was a nationalist movement, but why didn't they join the Ba'ath? And to answer that question, they actually did have meetings with Michel Aflaq in Beirut, and there was a discussion about them becoming part of the Ba'ath, but those discussions failed. The Movement of Arab Nationalists was accused by the Ba'ath of being basically a bunch of young university students that were hot-headed and that were focused on themes that were driven by emotion and that were not essentially political enough for the Ba'ath leadership at the time. In the Movement of Arab Nationalist version, their argument was that the Ba'ath was not centering Palestine enough, and it hadn't fully grappled with the meaning of the Nakba and the catastrophe for the entire Arab world by not centering Palestine. So you had these competing accusations at this stage. Later on, of course, the Ba'ath, as it undergoes the transformations we spoke about in earlier episodes in the early 50s, it adopts a much more socialist vision. And it's arguing that you have to both develop a just society at the same time as pursuing unity and Arab unity and of course, Arab nationalism in the process. So this kind of view was contested by Movement of Arab Nationalist theorists. In particular, the main theorists in the 1950s, or the one who authored the most pamphlets, was Al-Hakam Darwazi, who argued that you have to separate between stages. There is a stage of national liberation in which the nation has to be at the center. And once sovereignty is gained and unity is achieved, then you can pursue the social struggle after you've completed the national struggle. This was, of course, a point of tension between them and the Ba'ath, and it was a fundamental difference between them and the communists. So they were also advocating visions of a classless society in the initial nationalist phase. They were like, you cannot create class competition and class struggle at the time when you're seeking national independence. So in that regard, they were identified by some Ba'athist figures at the time, as and definitely by communists, as displaying right-wing tendencies in that regard, because they were essentially saying, well, we don't deny that there are social justice issues, but we're not going to view history as a struggle between classes. It's a history is a sphere in which subjugated nations need to gain their freedom, and then, you know, they can figure out their internal contradictions in subsequent stages. And this was the two-stage kind of theory that people like Al-Hakam Darwazi and other Movement of Arab Nationalist figures were advocating throughout the 1950s. They were also, by the way, authoring severe attacks against the communist movement. And in some cases, like definitely in Kuwait, there are serious accusations against them, and quite credible ones, that they even were handing communist names to the authorities to get them arrested and so on. You know, again, because of, in this case, their main motivation was the view that the communists were complicit in the loss of Palestine, and that essentially they were agents of a Soviet Union that had supplied the Czech weapons deal in the 1948 war, thus playing the decisive role in the establishment of the State of Israel, and that had given diplomatic cover for the establishment of the State of Israel by initially supporting the and in fact pushing for the UN partition resolution in 1947, and later on, you know, supporting it and ensuring that it got adopted. So their view of the communist movement was colored by that. and they were viewing it from that lens. They changed later on. And this is what's curious about movement of Arab nationalists, is that it later on adopts Marxism, you know, as a result of a series of major ideological changes in the 1960s. But to go back to this initial phase, at this stage, their main mottos were, again, viewed by the Ba'ath and the communists with suspicion. I mean, their big motto at the time was Dam Hadid Nar Wahda Taharrur Thar. So, and that they would chant that in their demos. So it's blood, iron, fire, and then unity, liberation, and revenge. So what they were saying essentially, Dam Hadid Nar, that's the imperialism and Zionism and Arab reaction, which were the three kind of forces that they identified as the problem. That's the triumvirate. I mean, other movements also identified that triumvirate as a big problem affecting all Arabs. You know, most progressive movements did, but in the case of the Arab movement, Arab nationalists, they were seeing it as these are people that spilled the blood and forced in the world of steel and fire. The only response is unity and liberation and revenge. So they wanted revenge for the Nakba, revenge for the colonialism, revenge for all the affliction. And again, for the Ba'athists, who were more experienced, older, had been influenced by socialist and communist ideology at an earlier stage, that sounded like stuff that was more on right-wing talk. It's not progressive talk as far as they're concerned. It's like kind of a land and blood type of way of looking at the world.
Yeah, revenge is not really a word in the left-wing lexicon, typically.
No, it's not. And this is why later on the movement of Arab nationalists engages in harsh critiques of the slogan and other slogans that they adopted in this period. And certainly the leftist current that takes it towards Marxism denounces this period. You had also some various adventurous currents within the movement that were demanding engagement and activity, and I'm using the word here in a sociological sense, not in the American ideological sense. They were engaging essentially in terrorist tactics in the early 50s. And sometimes they were promoting all sorts of agendas like assassinations and you know, that were not viewed as fitting in with a more progressive agenda. Nevertheless, that should not take us away from the progressive side of this movement, which is that it was actually very keen on combating colonialism, and it was very keen on combating reactionary Arab regimes, and it was keen on combating Zionism. So in a way, they had identified the problem well, they diagnosed the problem, but their solutions were not initially left-wing solutions.
And it had substantial Palestinian leadership.
It had substantial Palestinian leadership. And in that sense, it really centered Palestine and Palestinian struggles in a good way.
I'm Naomi Klein, and you're listening to The Dig, my go-to podcast for the most thoughtful, in-depth conversation on the left. It's an incredible place to be exposed to new ideas and new writing. And if you can, please become a sustaining supporter at Patreon.
This episode of The Dig is brought to you by our listeners who support us at patreon.com and by Verso Books, which has loads of great left-wing titles, perfect for Dig listeners like you. One that you might like is Future of Denial, The Ideologies of Climate Change by Tad DeLay. The age of denial is over, or so we're told. Emissions continue to rise while gimmicks, graft, and greenwashing distract the public from the climate violence suffered by the vulnerable. This timely interdisciplinary contribution to the environmental humanities draws on the latest climatology, the first shoots of an energy transition, critical theory, paleoclimate history, and trends in border violence, all to answer the most pressing question of our age. Why do we continue to squander the short time we have left? Will capitalists ever voluntarily walk away from hundreds of trillions of dollars in fossil fuels unless they're forced to? And if not, who will apply the necessary pressure? Tad DeLay tackles these questions head on in his book, Future of Denial, The Ideologies of Climate Change. out now from Verso Books.
One thing I should note, the movement, for all its ideological shortcomings at this stage, certainly if you're coming at it from a left-wing perspective, you would definitely consider that it had major ideological shortcomings. For all of these ideological shortcomings, it was engaged in important struggles.
Yeah, you mentioned that they were attracted to the sort of 19th century secret society model. And Zurich and the Arab clandestine movement had this major influence on how the organization was organized. But what exactly were the Arab nationalist youth after 58, the movement of Arab nationalists? What were they up to throughout this decade? What was its size, strength, and presence across the region? The movement's ultimate importance is absolutely undeniable, but how much of a force were they in the 1950s?
So in the 1950s, they're still smaller than the communists in the Ba'ath, but they are making a presence, you know, and it depends really on the zone. So their influence is felt definitely in Beirut, because that's where the movement was founded. And it was beginning to actively try to recruit youth in Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, alongside the traditional students that had constituted basically the main cadres of the movement. So in that way, you know, when it comes to their grounding sociologically, and when it comes to class backgrounds, initially they were very similar to the Ba'ath in the sense of the students were the backbone, you know, but then you had all these young people also in refugee camps that were beginning to join. And the method of propagating their principles was through the classical medium, which was the newspaper. You know, they had this mini kind of magazine / newspaper that was, again, in line with the motto that we described. It was called Al-Thar, the Revenge. And basically, it highlighted, if you look at all the early editions, it was talking about the misery of the refugees, of the Palestinian refugees, the horrors that they were facing. And it was identifying the main cause of these horrors as the division of the Arab lands, the failure of these Arab states that have been founded by colonialism at confronting the challenges of modernization and modernity, emphasis on unity and struggle against colonialism as the only way forward. These were the kind of themes that they were focusing on. And also, they were focusing on combating peace agreements with the recently established Israeli state. So they had established something called Hayat Mukafahat al-Sulh ma Israel, the committee to combat peace with Israel, because they were worried that there was an American project to liquidate the Palestinian cause. And we spoke about it in earlier episodes. They were worried about all of these plans that were floating around from the days of Hosni Zaim onwards.
And it's an American project, of course, that continues very much through the present day.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, you know, that was something they focused on. They were calling for boycotts against colonialists and boycotts against, you know, those entities that support the Israeli state. They also were promoting major solidarity initiatives with Arab revolutions across the region. So one of their biggest involvements in the early 50s was in demonstrations to protest the expulsion of Mohammed al-Khamis, Mohammed V, from Morocco on the hands of the French authorities. They were demonstrating for Tunisia. Of course, that early part of the 1950s witnessed huge struggles around Tunisia, Morocco, and of course, after 54, the Algerian Revolution. So they came out very strongly in support of these struggles. The main critique they had against the Ba'ath, but also to some extent the communists as well, was that they were not focusing enough on the entirety of the Arab region. So that they were a bit like centered on the old Eastern Arab capitals, Baghdad and Damascus and Beirut and Jerusalem and Cairo, and that the Ba'ath could not engage like other areas. They were, of course, that was not entirely fair, because the Ba'ath was operating in multiple arenas. But the movement of Arab nationalists emphasized struggles across the region, and they were promoting it. In terms of reach and strength at this stage, it's difficult to estimate numbers, Daniel, but what's clear is that they were very strong in Beirut. They were very strong in Palestinian circles in Jordan, and including, of course, the Palestinian West Bank at this stage. In Syria, they were beginning to develop. In Iraq, they had a nascent presence. In Kuwait, they were very strong. So at this stage, what you have is the only place where they actually had dominance and where that you could say that they were the strongest progressive force, or force that considered to be within the progressive realm, at least within the anti-colonial family of movements in the region, was in Kuwait. They were able to build a phenomenal movement there. And this was partly because others did not have the older network that they had in Kuwait. The movement of Arab nationalists really, which was led by Ahmed al-Khatib, Dr. Ahmed al-Khatib, a very talented organizer that had, after graduating from AUB as a doctor, he went back to Kuwait. And he set up a practice there, was able to really push forward and pursue these principles, but he had help from all of those that had preceded him in that space. You know, so in Kuwait, they did really well, and they expanded heavily.
You write, quote, "Kuwait was the most economically and politically dynamic territory in the Gulf region in the 1950s. Why? And what did that look like?
Well, quite simply, I mean, first of all, education came to Kuwait early. And secondly, Kuwait, by the time we get to the 50s, was witnessing an unprecedented and incredible economic boom as a result of the discovery of oil. So you had the expansion of the economy at a meteoric pace. And at the same time, partly because of the presence of these Arab nationalist ideas in Kuwait early on, there was an enthusiasm in Kuwait for recruiting Palestinians in particular to participate in this boom. So you had this substantial, very substantial Palestinian population. At some point, actually, the numbers of Palestinians were close to the numbers of Kuwaitis in Kuwait. You know, it was a very large community. At its height, 400,000 people in a country that was very small, without a very small population. So this provided, first of all, for a very vibrant politics. But already there had been a vibrant politics in Kuwait before because of the presence of these civic movements, the reform movement, as I mentioned, the clandestine Arab movement. You even had Islamic reformist currents in Kuwait that had existed before. So Kuwait was in a very interesting position. And we should remember, Kuwait was actually, for the longest time, still within the Ottoman world, unlike the rest of the Gulf, which had been in a way severed from its surrounding regional environment since the British established their paramountcy there in the 19th century. So Kuwait entered the British realm at a later stage, and it always had a stronger civil society than most places. Often when people talk about the history of Kuwait, they speak of it as a sort of a contract between a merchant class, a social contract between a merchant class and a ruling family, in this case, the Al-Sabah, which cannot be said for other monarchies in the Gulf region. Now, of course, the ruling family gained in power initially with British support and help. The British, by the way, were the people that were responsible for limiting the success of the reform movement in Kuwait and the constitutional movement there and the movement for democracy, essentially. But at the same time, the elements from this movement were still there. And you had the merchant class that was willing to back ideas of Arab nationalism still in the 1950s. This did not continue forever. As the movement of Arab nationalism started becoming more socialist in orientation, and definitely by the time it adopts Marxism, it loses that support for class reasons that are very clear. But initially, they had gained support because the Kuwaiti merchant class was patriotic. It was anti-colonial. Not all of it, but there were sections of it that were. Nevertheless, of course, they had class interests.
They were not anti-capitalists.
They were not anti-capitalists. So the minute the movement becomes anti-capitalist, they go somewhere else. But initially, in the 50s, there's this atmosphere where the movement can recruit educated young people, can recruit amongst Palestinian communities. And importantly, it was able to recruit people from other parts of the Arabian Peninsula, from Bahrain, from Dhofar in Oman.
Which becomes extremely important in terms of the establishment of the Dhofar Liberation Front.
Absolutely. And from the Yemen, especially South Yemen, what was referred to by the British as Aden and the Protectorates. The movement of Arab nationalists established movements in all of these arenas through its Kuwaiti branch. And the advantage of Kuwait is that because its economy was so strong, it was attracting all these migrant laborers from across these countries. And these migrant laborers brought with them a different class background to the movement of Arab nationalists as well. Because it may have started with Palestinian students and Kuwaiti students and that knew that they had a big future ahead of them. But then it was spreading in Palestinian refugee camps, as I mentioned, in Lebanon. You know, they had recruited talented organizers like Salah Salah and others. It was also spreading in places like the Kuwait Oil Company fields, where Dhofari workers were working and where Yemeni workers were working. So the class portfolio of the movement was also changing as it became more and more embroiled in organizing at the time.
It's a different way to think maybe about the geography of the region beyond the colonizer drawn lines of the nation state, the way these places like Kuwait, like Beirut, like Cairo, gather Arab radical thinkers and organizers together to create new ways of thinking about and doing politics.
Absolutely. And I hate using this term now, but I used to use it when I was writing my PhD and never like actually ended up writing it at the time, but then it got picked up by others who take it in a different direction. But I used to speak of Kuwait as a revolutionary hub of sorts. And I'm again, like, I don't want it to be confused with the current usage of these kind of concepts. But for me, I was referring to a very material reality, which is, you know, these were places in which people congregated initially for economic reasons, but they became places where there was cross-fertilization of ideas and where you could create nodal points for the spread of radical ideas. And for a variety of reasons, the politics of Kuwait allowed for a plurality of views and for a less repressive atmosphere around political discussions. I don't want to romanticize it. The British were still in charge. But they had to account for a balance of social forces in which civil society was strong, Daniel. So it allowed for a margin of discussion and a margin for publications to emerge and a margin for exchanges to take place, even if at a relatively clandestine level. So the movement of Arab nationalists, for example, did not operate officially as a movement or as a party, but it had sports clubs, it had cultural societies, it operated through them. These were kind of fronts for it. Now, everybody knew that these were fronts for it, but they were tolerated enough until, of course, they got into moments of severe tension with the regime, like when they demanded that the regime stop being monarchist and join the United Arab Republic in 1958. That was their big crisis, their big clash with the Kuwaiti authorities was around that time. But initially, Kuwait was being ruled by a figure, Abdullah Salim, which was seen as being more of a reformist ruler that was relatively lenient when it came to questions of political repression.
This, before we move on from Kuwait, this goes well beyond the historical scope of our discussion today, but we should note that Kuwait expelled hundreds of thousands of Palestinians after the Iraqi invasion and the first Gulf War, and so many refugees were made refugees a second time over then.
Yes, but that has a completely different context, and we'll talk about it later on. At this stage, what's interesting is that it absorbed hundreds of thousands.
Right.
So at this stage, it absorbed them and also absorbed them enthusiastically at this stage.
Right.
Like, and I'm talking here both on the level of society, of course, in which there was so much sympathy for the idea of Palestinian refugees coming, as well as on the level of the upper echelons of government. And they had different reasons. I mean, everybody was sympathetic to the Palestinian cause at this stage in Kuwait. There was no question about that. But also, they knew that when it came to the higher authorities, they knew that they were gaining a professional population, a population that had, by regional standards, a very high level of education. Despite all the British obstacles to Palestinian education, nevertheless, Palestinians had a focus in their And it's precisely because of the anti-colonial culture that they had developed. Part of that culture was an emphasis on education as a way forward.
And Palestinians still today have one of the highest rates of educational attainment in the world, which goes a long way to explaining the central role of scholasticide in Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza.
Absolutely. The scholasticide dimension has to do with that. It's a way of disrupting people's resistance through destroying their culture, through destroying their ability to reproduce themselves, but also through destroying the knowledge within Daniel. And I've been working very hard, actually, on this dimension. We've produced a scholasticide toolkit through a movement that I'm part of, the Scholars Against War in Palestine. We've done a lot of work on this. And of course, the Palestinian focus on education only increased after the Nakba. Because when people are made refugees, and this was a landed people, this was a most Palestinians, most of us are come from the peasantry. You know, we're in villages, we're farmers. Others belong to urban backgrounds, but they were basically urban craftsmen, and you know, and then you had a small class of dominant notable families. But on the whole, this is a very humble population that is tied to the land. Once it loses the land, it loses everything, loses its livelihood. And the only people that made it were the people that had education. So it was understood by Palestinians as of 1948 that education is everything. That's why the minute the expulsions happened, even in the refugee camps, people were really strong on demanding schooling and on establishing schooling, on pursuing that. And they did everything they could to get their kids educated. And the minute you educated your kid, then the next step would be for them to find livelihood for them, for their brothers, for their mothers, for their fathers, for the whole extended family. Because otherwise it was destitution. One way of finding livelihood was to go and work in the Gulf and the Arabian Peninsula. And I'll tell you something, hundreds of thousands of Palestinian lives were spent working there, contributing to the essentially building of these societies. As part of course, like a global migration wave, as a result of this dispossession that Palestinians experienced. So there was a disproportionate percentage of Palestinians that were involved in that, and Kuwait had the largest number. That's why Kuwait was very important, and we're going to see this later on, in the establishment of Palestinian national structures. Okay. Now, the second arena, Daniel, because you asked, and later on we can come back to Kuwait in a second. I know you want us to come back to it. But second arena in which the movement of Arab nationalists was very strong was Jordan and the West Bank. There, the what had happened is after they graduated from AUB, the founding members of the movement ended up going back to the areas they came from. Now, George Habash and Wadih Haddad could not go back to, obviously, Lid, which is in the part of Palestine that essentially upon which the Israeli state was founded. It's now Lud. So if you go to the airport, the Ben-Gurion airport, that's actually in their hometown. And that hometown, by the way, now is a total Palestinian ghetto surrounded by very violent Israeli colonists that attack. It's a place of social strife and struggle. And there's many problems relating to ghettoization, drugs, police repression. You know, it's a place that has been affected by the horrors of colonialism in very severe ways. So they were not able to go back there. It's a place that had witnessed a big massacre against their people. And of course they knew that, and they were banned from going there. They had become refugees. The place they could go was Jordan,
which included at this point the West Bank. And as we've discussed, there was this incredible rebellious moment in 1956, 57, I believe, where there's a political opening in Jordan, and there's a more nationalist government under Suleiman al-Nablusi, and Palestinians are playing a major role in these struggles.
Of course, and of course, the movement of Arab nationalists is part of this movement. So what happens is, you know, in the early 50s, George Habash, Wadih Haddad, they go to Amman. What they do is they establish a people's clinic. And that was in line with the views of the movement of Arab nationalists at the time. This is why I'm telling you, it's a weird melange between like some reactionary like slogans, but also there are progressive social practices that were involved in it. So there was this idea that the poor are denied medicine. So these people were like, you know what? We're going to open a people's clinic and we're going to offer free medicine for the poor. And they were not charging. They had this volunteerist mindset, but also that allowed them then to build a base of support. Because these were these young men that everybody admired. They knew that they could be making, you know, a huge amount of money. You know, there were very few doctors at the time, Daniel. And if you're a doctor, everybody that was a doctor at that stage could make like millions, or what was the equivalent of millions back in those years, because it's just scarcity. And these people were like, you know, George Chavez graduated top of his class in AB Medical School, which is a very good medical school, excellent medical school, you know. So he was not a bad doctor. He was a very good doctor. And he's coming in, instead of like going and treating the rich and getting making money, he's treating the poor. That gave him social prestige in those circles. And he started recruiting people. And they would recruit them, you know, in a clandestine way. People would hear about these radical doctors. They would come, they would join them. And they started publishing a newspaper, Al-Ra'i, not to be confused with the current official Jordanian government mouthpiece, Al-Ra'i, the opinion. Originally, Al-Ra'i was a movement of Arab nationalist outfit, or Shabab Qawmi Arabi outfit, Arab nationalist youth outfit. So anyways, the atmosphere at the time was very amenable to the ideas that these guys were promoting. And they were able to build a base and to recruit effectively into that base. Now, in addition to the People's Clinic, you had in Amman, Wadi Haddad ends up also going, he eventually goes down to the Jordan Valley. And he starts working in clinics that are treating people in the refugee camps there. You know, and especially later on, like he became a prominent figure in Karame camp, which later witnessed the Battle of Karame, of course. It was the site of the famous Battle of Karame after 67. We'll talk about the battle later on. So again, he was building a base there. So they were focusing on recruitment in these areas, refugee camps, working class areas in the Jordanian capital. He managed to recruit both West bankers and East bankers. A lot of people who came from Jordan proper, you know, they joined the movement. A lot of people who also were in the West Bank, of course, joined the movement because it had a pan-Arab ethos. It did not discriminate on the basis of where you came from in this region. The idea was any Arab from any country could go and rise and achieve prominence in this movement. So one of the figures that they recruited from the East Bank was a Jordanian figure called Naif Hawatmeh. Later on, he would establish a breakaway group that is now known as the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Incidentally, Naif Hawatmeh is the only one of the historic founding figures of Palestinian revolutionary movements that is still alive now. But he came from the East Bank town of Salt, and he had joined the movement of Arab nationalists at a time when it was, of course, dominated by George Habash and Wadi Haddad. So this environment meant that they had a strong presence in Jordan, and they had a strong presence in youth circles in Lebanon. Now, in Syria, they were still weak, but they were nascent and they were developing. In the Arabian Peninsula, as I mentioned, there's this Kuwaiti effect that ensures that they gain strength in this period. But what transforms the movement of Arab nationalists is a set of circumstances connected to, initially, the tripartite aggression against Egypt in 1956, because they start mobilizing against that. And secondly, and most importantly, they're seen as defending the establishment of the, and later on, combating the collapse of the United Arab Republic.
They become a key Nasserist force throughout the region.
They become so obsessed with Nasser after 56. Initially, like other movements, they're suspicious of Nasser and the free officers.
Right, because they're suspicious of military rule. They're suspicious of his ideology. They're suspicious of his relations with the British initially.
Relations with the Americans initially.
With the Americans.
They're not suspicious about the British. They're suspicious about the Americans. So with Nasser, Daniel, initially, as we've said before in previous episodes, initially, he's trying to signal to the Americans that I don't want problems with you. In fact, I want a very excellent relationship with you. I don't want a relationship with the Soviet Union. However, I have my parameters in my relationship with you. My parameters being that I won't join one of your military pacts. I won't break away from my aspiration, which is to seek a neutralist formula, which is something that a lot of scholars still misunderstand to this day, because they'll talk about American enthusiasm for him and even people around him making all these moves to reach out to the Americans and so on. And of course, he was very involved in trying to court the Americans, but he had like parameters around it. And of course, these included questions relating to Egyptian sovereignty, questions related to Palestinian cause, and questions related to the overall future of regional security. You know, not everyone understood that he had these parameters initially. And to this day, actually, some scholars, you know, they present it as a simple story of this was initially an American agent that later the Americans disposed of and he got better, and which is not a correct story. It's more much more complicated than that. He definitely had entanglements with the Americans that made people like the Ba'ath, the Movement of Arab Nationalists, suspicious. They also, of course, hated Hosni Zaim before, who they saw as an American stooge, and they saw as somebody who is starting a tradition of military coups. They did not like the idea of military men involved in politics, and rightly so, because it's a dodgy idea. And of course, even the Nasserist example had many ills as a result of the military's entry into politics, you know? So this is something they were very suspicious about.
But then the tripartite aggression, they convert zealously.
Between the Baghdad Pact, the Czech arms deal, the Bandung conference and the role he played in Bandung, the initiation of Saut al-Arab and the beginning of the promotion of when they hear on a Cairo radio promoting the Algerian Revolution, promoting protesting France and Morocco and Tunisia, promoting the liberation of the Arab world in its entirety, talking about the Palestinian cause and so on. That's music to their ears. They love it. They're like, you know what? It looks like we got it wrong. This is not an agent of imperialism. So that was like the initial. And then, of course, when he's talking about issues like land reform, as limited as it was in the initial stages of the Egyptian Revolution, but they like that too. You know, these kind of movements are like, okay, so there is a progressive element. Of course, you had other movements that were much more skeptical, like the communists. They were like, well, you know, he's talking land reform, but then, and he's talking like social justice, but then why is he executing workers when they're trying to protest, to demand their rights under the banner of protesting for the revolution, you know, against the capitalists? And why is he trying to look in front of the Americans as such a great crusader against communism and so on? You know what I mean? Like these kind of elements shed doubt, but at the same time, there are counterbalancing moves that are respected on the left, on the part of Nasser. And as the years go by, he does shift to the left even more. And the more he shifts, the more these people like it. Okay. But also in the case of the Movement of Arab Nationalists, it forces them to shift to the left too, even further.
That was the 8th episode of Thawara, the Dig series on 20th century Arab politics with Abdelrazak Tikriti, who teaches history at Rice University. A scholar of Arab and Palestinian revolutionary movements, he's the author of Monsoon Revolution, Republicans, Sultans, and Empires in Oman, and the co-author of The Palestinian Revolution Digital Humanities Website, an incredible resource that will be back online soon. Thanks for listening to The Dig from Jacobin Magazine. As Marx once said, after noting that revolutions are the locomotives of history, while other podcasts have only interpreted the world in various ways, our point is to change it. We're posting new episodes every week. The Dig was produced by Alex Lewis. Our associate producer is Jackson Roach. Music by Jeffrey Brodsky. Our communications coordinator is Sylvia Atwood. Our senior advisors are Theo Riofrancos and Ben Mabee. Check out our vast archives and newsletters at thedigradio.com. Follow us on Twitter and now also Instagram at thedigradio. And do find us wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to this podcast. If it's on iTunes or Spotify, also please leave us a nice review. Those reviews help introduce us to new listeners, but what really does that is you telling your friends to check out the pod, particularly Thawara. please make propaganda for us. And do find us at patreon.com/thedig and make a monthly or annual contribution to keep this operation up and running strong. Even a few bucks is huge.